When all is ready, I throw this switch.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous. Oh, wow. My voice cracked. It must have been hitting puberty.
Congratulations.
Famous. Okay, let's do that again. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Collected Edition comic book podcast, where we discuss the famous and infamous runs and story arcs throughout the history of comics. I am Paul Matthew Carr, and with me, as always, Mr. Brian Rees.
Hey, Paul, what's happening?
Oh, not much. Winter is almost upon us. Winter is coming.
Winter is coming. Dude, yeah. It's October.
I know, but it feels like winter. It's actually a cold day today after just months and months of sweltering heat. It's like, oh, it's cold today. Yeah. Weather. What a fun thing to talk about.
Should we talk about the government? Should we talk about the weather?
Hey. Stand in the place where you are. So today on the program, we will be discussing an incredible topic, the Sensational She-Hulk by John Byrne. In fact, I think this entire, this is going to be nothing wall-to-wall Hulk related.
Episode. What kind of Walters? That was a push.
It's gentrification.
I didn't smash it.
Well, first, do you want to talk about the fun stuff first or the annoying stuff first?
Oh, well, fun is always better than annoying.
Okay. Well, at the time of this recording, no idea when you're listening to it, there's 8 episodes? Is it 8 episodes of the She-Hulk?
I think we're 7 in.
7 in. Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
It doesn't matter. We're
well into.
Yes. Yes. We're nearing the end of the She-Hulk run. Of the television series. And so far, I have been enjoying the hell out of this show.
Oh, it's great. Yeah, it's so funny to watch the sad boys. you know, it's like, you do understand that it's a set up as a sitcom. It's called She-Hulk, Attorney at Law, or whatever.
Or whatever it is this week.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's Ally McBeal with superpowers.
Right. And it features one of the best actresses around, who is still doing killer work, in Tatiana Maslany, who's nailing it, absolutely killing it. And yet all the sad boys out there are like, just, it's not very good because, you know, it doesn't have smashing.
Yeah. And just saying, you know, it's an anti-male show. It has
an anti-troll show.
Well, it's definitely an anti-troll show, which makes me happy.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think that contributes to some of the, you know, incel kind of comments or whatever, you know, it's like, because they're making fun of them and boy, are they not happy.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just think it's really well made. It's funny.
Funny. The characters are great.
Yeah. It's exactly what it's supposed to be.
All the supporting cast is great. It's a fun show. People don't understand that it's okay to be fun.
The other big criticism I've been hearing is that the CGI looks wonky, which it kind of does at certain times. It looks a little rubbery, but that does not bother me in the slightest.
Well, these are the people complaining about the CGI in here think the original Hulk television show is like the great standard by which all superhero television shows should be based on. And you want to talk about bad CGI? Well, first of all, there's no CGI.
Yeah, but they're, you know, phenomenal wig work in that.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, like the original Hulk series looks terrible. Lou Ferrigno looks nothing like Bill Bixby.
It's fine for what it is, and for the time it was made, the original Hulk series is fine. Right, I liked it. I was a kid at the time, but.
Yeah, but none of these people are complaining about the special effects in the original Hulk.
No. And that comes, this is where I come from. I'm a man of an older demographic. You know, I grew up watching classic Doctor Who with cardboard and styrofoam and just enjoyed it because the story was good. And yeah, even as a kid, I knew, yeah, these special effects are crap. But it didn't matter because the show was good.
Right.
Compared to that, this show is phenomenal.
Yeah.
You know, so it looks a little rubbery sometimes. It doesn't matter as long as the show is good. And the show is good.
And I'm not certain that that's not on purpose. Some of it's budget, sure. Some of it's, you know, there's a variety of issues going, but that has nothing to do with the writers. It has nothing to do with the writing of the show. It has nothing to do with the actors in the show.
Yeah. I actually think, and I don't know this, this is my speculation. I think that they made concessions. Like, hey, we can't have, you know, lifelike CGI because we need the actress to shine through. So I think they weighted it more towards, I can never say her name.
Tatiana Maslany.
I think they weighted it more towards, you know, giving her expression and her performance rather than burying her in all the CGI.
Right.
That's, I mean, and that's more important, you know, for the show to get her expression, her, because she's wonderful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And well, and the other critique is it's like all these morons sitting around waiting for Daredevil.
I would love it if Daredevil just doesn't show up.
Yeah.
And it's just, they were just teasing it in the trailers and stuff.
Because like every episode, you know, people are just complaining because Daredevil's not there. I was like, the last I checked, the show is called She-Hulk. It's like, well, you know, just wait till the show is over, find out if he's in one of the episodes and watch that and settle down. Like a 24 episode Daredevil in a year or two. Take a breath.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's a cameo, not the, you know, it's not what the show is about. Yeah, so I mean, I love it. I mean, I really have been enjoying this show, especially like with lines like, oh, Wong's in this one. That's like Twitter armor for a week. I love that. Yeah. And then they scroll through. It's really great satire on how entertainment is perceived today and critiqued upon today, and comics in general, and man babies in general. And aside from all that, it's just fun. It's a really fun show.
Yeah. I mean, it's at some point, you know, can't we all just sit back and say, I would like to be amused and entertained for a half an hour rather than have something be elevated into a thing that is a level of importance that doesn't need to be assigned to a thing.
Exactly.
But not every Marvel show has to have like the swelling music and, you know, the grand cosmic moments.
Mm-hmm. And this actually does have those grand cosmic moments, albeit in short little spurts. That, you know, it's still setting up for something else, you know, doing what it's supposed to. And it has cameos from Man Bull and and Porcupine.
Porcupine.
Mr. Immortal.
The Matador.
Yeah. My God.
You have a self-help group of villains.
The Wrecking Crew is in it, which is just, you know, the most D-list of Marvel villains. I love it. I think it's great. More like this. I think, and all right, I'm just going to throw this out there. The Disney Plus programs have been getting such, have just been shit upon, basically, about how cheap they are. They're so different. I think they're knocking it out of the park. I mean, between Scarlet Witch.
Some of them I like better than others, sure.
Well, yeah, of course.
And if I mean, the big thing for me is like, if I don't like something, I have a remarkable power called a finger and a remote that allows me to not have to watch a thing that I don't like.
Yeah, exactly. But so far, I've liked them all. I mean, and again, like you said, some of them are better than others, but they're all well-made and entertaining. You know, it's fine. And some of them are just absolutely stellar. Yeah.
Is She-Hulk the best of them? Probably not.
No.
Am I entertained for half an hour without getting my underpants in a bunch? Yep.
Yeah, it's good. I just enjoy something for what it is, not what you think it should be.
Yeah, it's such a weird world sometimes with this stuff.
Yeah, fandom is just... Yeah, we'll have to go into a deep dive at that with that sometime. But fandom, man. It's okay not to like something, but it's not okay to be an asshole about it.
Yeah.
And speaking of being an asshole about it, let's talk about John Byrne real quick. Yeah. So the comic we're going to talk about is Sensational She-Hulk by John Byrne in his heyday period of the 80s and 90s. But I feel like we need to address some issues of John Byrne before we get into that. So when we talk about the comic, we can just talk about the comic.
Yeah,
and not have to talk about this guy. John Byrne has said some stupid shit. I'm dropping curses all day today. I don't know. Should I be? I'm going to have to censor myself.
We haven't dropped the F-bomb yet, though, right?
No, yeah. So sorry if, you know what? It's our program. We can do whatever we want. We can do whatever the hell we want. So anyway, John Byrne, he's not as controversial as other creators that we could mention.
Right.
But he has said some stupid things over the years. Kind of his awful, but the least of his indiscretions is opposition to creators' rights.
Yeah, that was and I don't, do we know if he still adheres to that?
I think so, although he's not as vocal about it anymore. But yeah. I still think he feels so. The idea is that it all started when Jack Kirby in the 80s kind of came out and said, you know, rightfully, that he hasn't been given his due. He hasn't, Marvel hasn't paid him what he's worth and given him credit for the helping to create the Marvel universe and half of the characters that were in it. And then John Byrne wrote a editorial where he basically said that, and I'm paraphrasing, but that Kirby needs to shut up. And every creator goes in and they know what the deal is. So do you take what you get, basically? He said he was proud to be a company man.
Right. And I think he even said like a cog in the machine.
Mm-hmm. Which brings us to Steve Gerber, who's, you know, is well known. He's one of my favorite comic book writers of all time. He wrote an issue of Destroyer Duck, penciled by Kirby, by the way, in which he created a character called Booster Cogburn, who was a spineless company man with no genitals, and he was just made of all ego. So Steve Gerber, his satire isn't subtle, but it is scathing.
Yeah.
So this started a big feud within the comic book community. At one point, John Byrne and Jim Shooter got into a shocking. I know that he and Jim Shooter would start arguing with each other.
Two of the nicest guys in comics, right? Yeah. There. I mean, Byrne has had a few. He's had some anti-trans comments. He's had some anti-immigration comments. He's had he has some issues with women.
Yeah,
I think, but we bring this up. I think only because, like you said, we want to let's get this out of the way before we talk about a comic book that he did. Because at the end of the day, John Byrne is responsible for some absolutely incredible comics.
Oh my God, his Fantastic Four run alone. If that's all he did, he would be considered one of the best writer artists in the history of comics. But he was doing that alongside of the X-Men, Captain America, the Avengers, and various other things.
Alpha Flight.
Well, yeah, we can forgive him for Alpha Flight.
Oh, dude, I like Alpha Flight.
I know. I was just kidding.
Yeah, no, it's I wanted to get that out of the way first to say that. I think we are probably both positively aligned with the comic we're reading, but we have to acknowledge that. I think with Byrne, sometimes he's the creator owned thing. I think is the ownership thing is the worst part of it. I think that sort of choose my words very carefully here. I think his comments on trans persons and his comments on immigration were probably more largely cranky old man off the cuff without thinking through what he was saying before he said it.
Right. And
that's not an excuse.
Yes. And I want to preface this by saying I don't agree with him. And I'm not trying to excuse him. At the same time, I'm not sure if what he's saying is he might believe these things, but it's always said in a way to deliberately push someone's buttons.
He's an agitator.
Exactly. It's like he's cranky and controversial for the hell of it. You know, like his the things he said about immigrants, he said in relation to Superman coming from Krypton.
Right.
And then he made some jackass remark about immigrants need to be happy. Same thing with creators' rights. They need to be happy with what they got. You know, I don't know. Like, do you believe that? Or are you just trying to stir up controversy and I don't know.
And I think people, the creator's rights thing, because he's never been, nobody thinks of John Byrne when they think of like people at the forefront of fighting for creator's rights.
Yeah. At the same time, he was given in the 1980s, one of the biggest contracts that Marvel ever gave out. So why would he care about what other people get? Because he got his money.
Right.
And people before him didn't get contracts like that. And that's, I go off on a rant about that.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like when you think about people standing for creators' rights, I mean, even your favorite comic book creator, Frank Miller, you know, who also has their issues with other things, is one of the, for a long time, was at the forefront of, creators' rights. So you could be a crank and a whack job and still stand for your fellow comic book creators.
I guess there are people out there saying, as long as I'm getting as long as I'm getting mine, I don't care what everybody else gets. And that's that's just a shitty way to be.
Yeah. And Byrne is kind of a shining example of that. I got mine. You know, he was a superstar. He kind of, his developmental period from his start to becoming a superstar was relatively small. Like, he became a big deal pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know? But it's always, you notice, it's always based on other people's work. He's, right. You know, he's maybe carrying on or even improving upon that someone else's work, but he's always riding someone's coattails. The final thing on this is the reason I am willing to give John Byrne a pass on these things is because the great Gail Simone has come out and said, and I have the quote here, he's very opinionated, but lots of artists are very opinionated. I'm okay with that. John Byrne is brilliant, and his forceful personality is part of that. So if Gail Simone says it's okay, I'll say okay. Okay, Gail.
I'd be curious how recent that quote is, but...
I think I have it here. 2006. So, okay. Yeah, that was a while back. Never mind, because the trans stuff came out fairly recently. Yeah,
it's hard to know if her
opinion has changed. Anywho, that's it. I just wanted to address that we do know that John Byrne is controversial and said some stupid stuff over the years, but he wrote a damn good comic book, which is what we're going to talk about.
Yes,
and we're going to judge it. Can we do Death of the Author with this one? I don't think we can, since the author is literally in the.
The author is a character in the.
Well, let's take a break and we'll contemplate that. And when we come back, we'll talk about the sensational She-Hulk.
Toadman Byrne? Really? Toadman?
You like cheap comic books, right? Well, I'm Professor Allen, and I talk about cheap comic books on the Quarterbin Podcast. In every episode, I'll dissect a single comic from my collection, as long as I paid no more than 25 cents for the issue. Forget about $4 new comics that you can read in 4 minutes, or crossover events that can cost $100 to collect. Join me in the Quarterbin, where even bad comics are a bargain, and good ones are a steal. The Quarterbin Podcast is part of the Relatively Geeky Podcast Network. Visit us at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com or search Relatively Geeky or Quarterbin Podcast in iTunes. I guarantee it'll be worth every penny.
Okay, and we're back. Paul, you recommended the sensational She-Hulk. Would you like to tell us about it?
Yes, indeed. There were so many pauses there, I didn't know whether I should jump in. But how long does it take for a character to go from cynical cash grab to beloved hero? In the case of She-Hulk, roughly 9 years. She-Hulk was created as a direct result of the Bionic Woman. That character was created as a female spin-off of the $6 Million Man. And, as there was no female version in the source material, Universal and the creators of the $6 Million Man had exclusive rights to the Bionic Woman and, of course, all the profits. Fearing the same would be done with The Incredible Hulk, a popular TV show airing on CBS at the time, Marvel hastily put out their own female version of the Hulk to retain the rights if this did happen. And so, in 1980, She-Hulk debuted in her own comic created by Stan Lee and John Buscema. The original series could be graciously described as contractually obligated legal requirement. After that, She-Hulk would make other guest appearances in other books and teams, most notably becoming a member of the Fantastic Four, written and drawn by John Byrne, who evidently took a shine to her and relaunched her solo series in 1989 with the publication of the sensational She-Hulk. This series broke with convention. It broke with tradition. It broke the fourth wall. This was a series that was unlike anything being made at the time. Sure, there had been characters in the past that occasionally broke the fourth wall, but not to this degree. She-Hulk not only addressed the audience, she pleaded with the writer and editors to change her storylines. She utilized layouts and panels to travel to different locations. She ripped through pages to move the plot along. The physical comic book itself became part of the story, and the readers themselves were not simply passive viewers, but actively engaged in the telling of the story. And the series poked fun at the tropes and cliches of comic books, at the publishers, at the creators, and at the fandom. It was a satire, a parody, a deconstruction of the medium, all while being extremely funny and entertaining. She-Hulk went from being a legal loophole to one of the most dynamic characters in comics, starring in one of the most important and innovative series in history. It went on to inspire multiple imitators and helped redefine how comic book stories could be told, all while not taking itself too seriously. In a word, it's sensational. Brian, what do you think of Sensational She-Hulk?
Well,
was I a bit hyperbolic there?
No. Oh, this is fun comics, right? I mean, this.
Yeah.
This is good times.
It is good times, and yes, in my introduction, I was being overly hyperbolic. But
this is comics for people who like comics,
right?
And not people who just like to read, you know, sequential soap operatic comics. This is for people who like the medium of comics.
And that's why I said, like, again, I know I was being hyperbolic, but I do think it's important in the way many creators after this would look at this series and say, oh, I don't have to stay within the frameworks, you know, inside the grid.
Right.
You know, I can be loose. It changed up how people wrote and drew comics. I mean, right. I mean, obviously the Deadpool in the room. So, I mean, Deadpool would go on and become famous for, you know, being a character that knew he was a comic book character.
Right.
But it started here. Yeah.
This isn't quite at the level of what Grant Morrison did in Animal Man, which was a very different thing. This is
strictly this is a comedy.
Right.
First and foremost, this was not taking itself seriously. This was it wasn't trying to change how comics were written. It was just, it was just being playful. Yes.
And I think we forget like how good of an artist John Byrne was, right? Some of the art in this is stunning.
And absolutely.
It's stunning in a cartoony way on purpose. You know, it's not just the narrative that he has fun with. It's visually how much fun he has.
Yes. And if you know anything about John Byrne, and as far as his comic books, his comic work, he's very enamored of the 60s and 70s and the comics that came out there. And he loved to pay homage to that. But not only that, he liked to play with it and make it a little bit different and see how far he could go, pushing that old style, utilizing that old style, but then pushing it into a more modern feel. And that's what he's doing here. He's taking this, he's making it look like an old 60s comic, but he's twisting it and playing with, you know, at this point in comics, it was starting to become cliche. They've been around for, well, how many years? Since the 1930s.
Right.
You know, and there was a set way of doing things. And he was saying, no, we're going to change it up. And almost simultaneously, Morrison's doing it in a much different way. It's right. A similar thing with anime.
Yeah, I didn't mean to draw a comparison to them, but I also want to acknowledge that Morrison was doing a thing at the time that Byrne was doing at the time. And they both have a sensibility to them, but they were very different in. So I want to acknowledge that Byrne isn't the only one doing it, but Byrne's doing it in a different way.
Right.
I don't want to say that Byrne is the only one.
Well, Byrne was doing a complete, well, I guess they both were doing a deconstruction of comic book, you know, tropes. Yeah. Whereas Byrne was doing it more in a comedic, you know, satire and parody.
They both have one is an existential angst and the other one is an existential humor.
Right. Exactly. It's kind of like how Man-Thing and Swamp-Thing were created almost simultaneously, but they were very different comic books as they went on.
Right. Just and I'm glad that you were able to work Man-Thing into this.
Hey, Man-Thing will be in, he's going to be in the MCU coming this Halloween. Hooray. There, I finally get to have my load of Man-Thing.
Don't be afraid.
Moving on. Yeah, maybe it was just something that was happening at the time. You know, comic books were changing throughout the 80s and especially early 90s.
Right.
You know, what can be done, what stories can be told with comics, even if it's just something like Sandman and Swamp Thing, but Alan Moore Swamp Thing, were really right. Changing how comic books were seen and appreciated and the way comic books were made, the way they were drawn and the way they were written was changing dramatically.
And part of that is that the audience was getting older. I mean,
a new audience was jumping on that wanted something more, less childish.
We were still in an age when you could get a new audience coming in. I think it's a discussion for a different time, and I think we've touched on it numerous times. But at the end of the day, the audience was suddenly starting to skew in a different age group. The primary exactly. audience was starting to skew in a different age group. So the nudge and wink that exists in She-Hulk would not have worked as well if the primary audience was you and I at 5 year old, at five, picking up a comic book from the newsstand, from Lawson's or the drugstore or the spinner rack.
Yes. And it expects a knowledge of comic books right. as you read it. You know, if you've never read a comic book before and you looked at this, you'd say, what the hell am I looking at?
Yeah.
But we've been, you know, he expects to have an audience that's been reading for a long time and has an understanding of what they're going into.
Well, I mean, that's important to this comic book. And again, I think as we touch on this, this is something I hadn't contextualized until we were having this discussion right now, is how important what this comic book means.
It's a very postmodern comic book, if you want to say it that way. Yeah, yeah.
We kind of talked ourselves into a new theory about this comic and comic books in general that I didn't initially take from my reading of this, but now I almost feel like how I'm going to talk about this going forward has subtly altered.
So I stand by my statement of one of the most important and innovative series in the comic books history. I stand by that statement.
My apologies to our thousands of fans who are now suddenly going to have to experience me working through a theory as we continue to talk about this now.
Yes.
As opposed to a thing when I came in.
Come on, Brian. Dust off those old deconstruction philosophy books. Let's get into this.
Well, I'm just going to look up at my framed picture of Derrida that I have. Above me right now, and I will allow him to guide me through this
with complete nonsense gibberish but intentional nonsense and gibberish.
Yes, well, yeah. The signifiers are there.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so let's get on with our postmodern discussion of a nonsensical comedy. The way this is set up is John Byrne took the first few issues of the old Marvel comics, of the Hulk, of Avengers, of Fantastic Four. And he modeled the first few issues on those, albeit with much more ridiculous situations and really crap villains, intentionally crap villains.
By the way, just as an insertion, did you go back and read the first 8 issues of Fantastic Four?
I did not, but I am vaguely familiar with them. I've read them a bunch of times, so...
Okay.
So I haven't done it. I didn't do my due diligence for this.
I asked this because apparently this is modeled.
Oh, yes. Yes, it is. Very much so.
And I think that's an important thing to note. And you know what? I didn't either, because those first eight issues are really hard to read.
They're a bit wordy.
Fantastic Four. Are they seminal? Yes. Are they entertaining to read in this day and age? Not so much. So I was like, I'm just going to take John Byrne's word for it.
Yeah. If you put them in the context of the history, when those first issues of Fantastic Four came out, it was unlike anything anyone had seen before.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
It was mind blowing. Yes. Now,
the reason I bring it up is that Byrne himself in the comics has She-Hulk say that every one of her issues is modeled after
Fantastic Four. Exactly.
After the first, each issue is modeled after the first issue, each, you know, concurrent issue of Fantastic Four.
Right. Yeah. With a little bit of the original Hulk run thrown in there and the original Avengers. He basically, and this gets back to that love that Byrne had of those old comics.
Right.
He intentionally modeled this series on those old ones in order to play with the genre, in order to change it up and point out how stupid they were, but at the same time saying how great they were, as every good satire should. It begins where you'd think it would always begin, in a circus. Well, should we talk about the Christmas issue first?
I would like to reference, so in the trade, because we are the collected edition, so yes, we're reading a collected edition. And so the collected edition starts off with a 5, 6, 7, 8 page Christmas episode, which I can't remember. Do we know where that was originally published?
I think it was in the back of an annual.
Was it a sampler? Yeah.
Yeah, or like a Christmas sampler or something like that.
Right. So it's an introduction, and not much about it is worth long discussion of, except it contains, it's just an introduction to She-Hulk. And
yeah, it's basically an announcement of the new series coming out. Right. Yes.
And it's set over Christmas, so Jen Walters is, you know, sad because it's Christmas Eve, right? And so she makes a phone call, and it contains one of my very favorite panels in the entire history of comics.
Which is?
And it's Ben Grimm, the Thing. So she's calling him. He's standing like in a window looking over Manhattan. It's just him from behind, and he's kind of, it's in his like more rocky phase.
Yeah.
But it's just a shot from him behind as the phone's ringing. There's a Christmas tree, and it's nighttime outside. He's standing in the window, and the dialogue box that he has just says Grimm. And it's his name. It's not G-R-I-M, it's G-R-I-M-M with the dot, dot, dots. And it's clearly a reference to Grimm and Gritty. And of course, the next panel, the next page, he picks up the phone and he's the ever-loving Thing. But it's just that great
Grimm.
So intentional. It's so on purpose. It's so funny when you see it and you understand the reference. I love that panel.
There's a lot of this that if you understand what the reference is, it makes it even, it's fine on its own, but if you understand the reference, it's we talk about Easter eggs all the time in programs and whatnot. This is it. That has been happening for quite a while now. And hey, Shulky, is how Grimm answers the phone.
He's not having a crisis at all. It's a wonderful panel that looks great, but is self-referential and is also funny.
Later in this, She-Hulk is visited by Dr. Doom and Magneto. You know, just basically throwing in all the, and Galactus. How could I forget Galactus shows up? It's not real. For instance, another great little reference is when Galactus shows up, she says, "Holy Mobius." referencing the Mobius,
The
artist. So yes, it's a funny line, but it also, if you get the reference. So anyway, this is all just...
it's an inconsequential bit of fluff.
Yeah, it's just to say, hey, look at all these really cool villains that are not really showing up.
That will never appear in this comic book.
sir, not appearing in this film. And so eventually Jan Walters does open up her Christmas gift, and it turns out to be issues of her new series.
Neat.
Merry Christmas. See you for the new series coming up. Yeah, it's a nice little bit of fluff, but to get you introduced to what you're going to see.
Right. And it's too bad they never go back to reference anything Christmas-oriented later on in the series.
No. Absolutely not. The first issue of Sensational She-Hulk has probably one of the most iconic covers in Marvel history, at least, which is She-Hulk holding up a copy of her original series run, saying, "This is your second chance. If you don't buy it this time, I'm going to come to your house and rip up all your X-Men." So even back then, the women were going to ruin comic books, dude. Yeah, see?
Especially women who are just stand-ins for men.
That's the thing. Yes, She-Hulk was created. That's why I wanted to do my introduction, was she was created to be, you know, to keep the rights. So that Marvel had the rights to a female version of the Hulk.
Right.
Just in case. It took several iterations, and several different writers along the way were trying to make this unique. And it wasn't until John Byrne took this over here that he made this a really interesting dynamic character. And she will go on. I mean, through Dan Slott and Charles Soule. And
only Nixon could go to China. Only John Byrne could do Shulky. Yeah. So anyway. Back to what you were saying, let's dive in.
We begin with the first mini arc, I guess you'd say, called Second Chance. See, I love even the titles of the...
Some of the titles of these are
brilliant. Yeah. So it begins with She-Hulk in a circus lifting pachyderms. And everything seems to be fine. It gives you a little bit of a backstory into... You know,
we have the Ringmaster, and
it gives you a little bit of backstory on how She-Hulk was created and what her backstory is. It's done very briefly, and then we get the Ringmaster and the Circus of Crime. God, 70s villains were the worst. So it's all circus based criminals,
right?
Yeah.
Well, and you know, but it's a circus, so of course you don't even have to say circus based criminal. Right. You just say circus and you automatically assume criminals.
Hashtag not all circuses.
Yeah, but this one is weird. Well, they're all weird. I'm sorry. I say a thing is weird when.
Yeah, this doesn't have too much of the, it has a little bit of the fourth wall breaking.
Mm-hmm.
But this is sort of, I think it isn't until issue 3, I think, that. Right. It really starts to come into its own.
He's starting, Byrne's kind of feeling things out to see what he can get away with.
Exactly.
And it should be noted that the great Tom DeFalco is the editor on this, and the great Bobby Chase is the assistant editor on this. So
yes, they have an interesting conversation coming up.
So, but it's definitely Byrne trying to figure out what he can get away with and what he can't get away with, I think. And it's kind of a standard. I mean, there's some ethically icky things about how did She-Hulk get colored all white? And I mean, all white top to bottom.
So Ringmaster has the ability to mind control people and turn them into zombie slaves, which right there is ethically questionable. He is a villain though. And then he disguises costumes She-Hulk up into a Glamazonia, is what he calls her.
Glamazonia.
Yeah. So there's some ethically icky. It's very 1960s.
Mm-hmm.
This whole storyline is very 1960s. Yeah. So she's hypnotized, She-Hulk, that is hypnotized into performing in the circus, but also stealing money from everyone in the audience.
Which is a great visual scene of her holding up an entire platform of
all the bleachers, I guess you'd say,
turning them upside down and shaking all their money out because they put seatbelts on.
Yes, exactly.
And then she shakes all their money. I love comics.
Everything just falls because, you know, this is a cash-based society. Not everyone has credit cards right now.
But most of this issue serves to introduce us to the headmen.
Yes. Crap villain team number two. So the headmen are this, what would you call them? They're evil scientists that have experimented upon themselves.
One of them has droopy skin. One of them is like a human head on a gorilla's body. One of them is Ruby, who is like a ball sitting on top of a woman's body.
Yeah, that can, you know, like hands can come out of it. It's really weird. But yes, I think, or it seems like John Byrne is just intentionally trying to do as many weird, wacky things in this first issue. Like you said, just to see, well, what can I get away with here? Eventually, She-Hulk regains her wits and tears everybody a new one, basically.
And there's a, again, going back to what Byrne is doing visually, and there's a whole bunch more coming into this, but there's a great scene where She-Hulk is back to herself and is chasing them. And what is it? She's like plowing them one way. And so there's these panels that show them running one direction, and the next panel, they're running the next direction. I mean, this is Marx Brothers stuff.
Oh, yeah. So they're all running in one direction, and then she throws a carriage or a cart of some sort in front of them, right, which causes them to turn around and run another way. And then she throws something in front of them, which causes them to run a different way. Yeah, it's if there was a set of doors, they could all be running in like Scooby-Doo.
Right. This is a masterclass on visuals.
Yeah, as far as drawing and depicting action, John Byrne's got it down. She eventually does throw a bunch of like wooden planks or bars of some sort. She just throws them up in the air, and it's really quite dynamic how they all fly down and create a prison cell around all the baddies. Yeah. And then the cops show up, and all is well. Should I address this here or wait? Let's just address it here. John Byrne does take, he goes out of his way to make sure that She-Hulk is in as little clothing as possible.
There's a strong cheesecake.
Now, the reason I bring it up is he is deliberately satirizing the tropes of comics. Is this him satirizing the trope that female characters are always half naked? Or does he just like half naked women in his comics?
And I think the answer is yes.
Little column A, little column B.
I think so.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Because
it's done for comedic effect. I don't think there's any prurient.
I don't think he's being. I don't think there's any malice. Or
there's a reference in a later issue to anything more, and we'd be in Epic Comics.
Yes, exactly.
Which was fantastic.
So it is happening, and I guess. I don't know. I've read enough John Byrne to know he kind of likes half-naked women in his comic books. But is it, I don't know, just the nature of this one.
Right.
Is it satire? Is it just pervy?
Yeah, but I think the whole shtick with...
The Hulk shtick.
It's comics in general. At the end of the day, how do costumes work? Right. You know, that's a whole, like, someone could do a whole 10-year long podcast about superhero costumes.
Well, you know, just the domino mask itself, how does that stay on?
Right.
You know,
and so at the end of the day, there are things that, you know, we all think in our heads, but we never say out loud. So superhero costumes are always kind of weird. So I don't know how much of this is, you know, pervy Byrne versus the acknowledgement that, you know, when someone calls out, I mean, the Incredible Hulk, you know, Banner, it's ridiculous when he hulks out, and yet he still has pants.
Yeah. They do that in the show where Mark Ruffalo says, your best friend, spandex.
Right.
Yeah.
But they didn't have spandex when, you know, Banner was first hulking out, and yet his pants still stayed on, even though they were torn at certain points. They weren't torn at other points.
Maybe it's just something that, you know, was expected to have happened in a comic book, but Byrne does hang a lampshade on it and say, I know this, what's happening here. Anyway, that was a long discussion on, you know, lack of clothing. Yes. Let's move on to the next issue with your people, your favorite people, Brian.
The Toadmen.
Toadmen.
Attack of the Toadmen, or Froggy Came a Courtin'.
Some of the titles here are fantastic. So She-Hulk is first introduced to her new apartment. She's taking over from Janet Van Dyne, the Wasp. So she's taking over while they're on the, while they're doing the, or I'm sorry, when Wasp is with the West Coast Avengers, her New York apartment is free to use. So She-Hulk is introduced to it, which we get a wonderful, there's a two-page spread of just showing the apartment with a note attached to it from Tom DeFalco saying, why are we doing a two-page spread when there's no action?
And it references Millie the Model.
Yes, it does. So the editors actually have a back and forth with studio notes tapped to the actual comic itself. This is where I believe the comic starts to figure out itself, what it wants to do, or John Byrne, I should say, figures out what he wants to do with this.
Well, it's the great, and I referenced this earlier, but it's the great scene where the Toad Men attack and She-Hulk literally looks at through the fourth wall, breaks the fourth wall. She's not talking to the reader. She's talking to the writer. And she's like, you know, Toad Men, Byrne, Toad Men.
Exactly.
Her writer.
Yes, it's what, and this happens several times throughout this. But we get this really wonderful back and forth where just Janet Van Dyne and Jen Walters are just having a conversation about their life and getting shown around the apartment. And meanwhile, there are these little notes stuck to the pages that says, well, at least that page has villains on it, but what is this? They're editorializing as the story is going along.
Right. It's mocking the whole editorial process. And
yeah. And it's nice that it does reference that it's good that the same artist is doing both of our magazines, so or doing both of our books, so we can cross over like this. After all of this kind of back and forth and getting shown her new digs, the Toad Men attack.
And of course, it turns out, and this is one of the great, what I think is one of the great visual things in this whole series is, of course, it turns out that they're not really Toad Men, they're actors wearing rubber suits, and everything is Mysterio, right? Been hired by the Headmen. I can never say without giggling for some reason.
Because you're eight.
Because I'm eight. But visually, it's some stunning visual work by Byrne where he's not breaking the fourth wall. He's breaking the comic panels. And it's like when She-Hulk realizes that this is an illusion and there's a thing around her, I can't even describe it well. It's this phenomenal visual thing where she is on her balcony and she is looking at a thing that's not the thing. It's like the vision of the city, and she rips it open.
Yes.
And she's ripping the panel open, and she does this numerous times again, but this is just really good art.
Yes, it's absolutely brilliant. It conveys all the action grandiose visuals that is expected in a comic like this, but it's also incredibly funny, and it's got great comedic timing, perfect pacing. Byrne really does know his stuff. But I need to acknowledge that this is the first appearance of Louise Grant, or Wheezy, and I want to get into this. We don't have to do it right now, but the existential nature of Wheezy,
yeah,
really is amazing to me.
Well, there's a great moment, and it's coming up in a couple issues.
Yeah,
with her at lunch, where she gives her history,
and that's where this is where I want to get into the existential idea. We can't just talk about the silly stuff. It has to go. We have to go into deconstruction, postmodern existentialism.
Right.
So anyway, we find out that this is all Mysterio's doing because Mysterio was hired by the Headmen. Giggle, giggle.
Right. Because their first plot failed.
Which
was the circus thing. But Mysterio actually wins out, knocks her out, and delivers her to the Headmen at the end.
Yeah. And again, we have a prone She-Hulk. Yeah.
This is a continuing theme of She-Hulk being knocked out and stripped of her clothes.
Yes. And they imply that they're going to cut her head off and put one of the other Headmen. They're going to put his head on She-Hulk's body because right now his head is on a mutated bird creature. Look, it doesn't matter. It's just incredibly weird. What they're going to do is they're going to cut off She-Hulk's head. And I can't even describe it. And now the next issue has special guest star Spider-Man. Because in the original third issue of Fantastic Four, Spider-Man did make a cameo appearance. That is a very well-known issue of Fantastic Four where Spider-Man has run out of money, so he tries to go to the Fantastic Four to get a job. My guest star, my enemy, is this issue. There is a really interesting, I think it's great, of Spider-Man looking over the side of a building and just the way he's thrown.
Yeah,
his feet are still stuck to the ground because he's sticky and his whole body is bent over and he's looking down. I really like the way, you know, you don't really get to see Spider-Man doing things like that, even though it makes perfect sense that he could.
Most of the visuals that we get with Spider-Man are often him knees up flying through the air, like with his web. This is a weird issue. So Spider-Man has to come save he fights Mysterio, so he has to come save the day. Like, he finds out from Mysterio that it's the headman that hired him to capture She-Hulk, right?
Yes.
So there's a lot of really weird things that happen in this.
Well, first of all, it's, you know, we're talking about decapitation. So The head of She-Hulk pops in to say, this is supposed to be a funny book. This ain't for kids. So she tries to lighten things by telling a very vaudevillian joke and then gets hit in the face with a pie.
The pie. And, you know, Brian Michael Bendis was very clearly paying attention to this series because, you know, it's not just this issue, but numerous issues have just panels of talking heads. Well, that's where Bendis got that from.
Oh, we're back to Bendis hate, are we? It's been a while. We've come full circle.
I'm merely acknowledging that one of Bendis's primary things is like a whole page of just little mini panels of heads talking. And in She-Hulk, it's not just this issue. There are numerous issues where there are multiple panels of a head, like tiny panels, like, you know, four across, eight down, or whatever it is, of just heads talking. And I don't know if it started with this, with headless She-Hulk.
Yes. Let's you know, we'll just make the definitive remark. This is where Brian Bendis got his idea from this comic book right now.
Floating head panels.
History's fun.
There's a couple moments of the She-Hulk head, and the head is supposedly connected to, you know, like we think that they cut her head off. Listeners can guess where this is going. How do you cut She-Hulk's head off? But this is not the first, there are a couple moments of her and with the floating head. And the best one isn't even the one with the pie. It's the one later where it's just her giving the history of like comics. And the whole, it's one of the most meta moments in the entire comic, or at least the issues we read, where she's literally talking about, well, the readers do this and the editors do this, and why am I doing it? It's great.
It really is. It's a little deep dive into comic books and how they're made. So Spider-Man comes in and he's trying to rescue She-Hulk, and she's bemoaning the fact that she can't see the fight because she's just ahead. But it turns out she wasn't just ahead at all. She's only been encased in some kind of computer box.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and the body that we saw is just a clone. So there's
a body that they put Chandu's head on that was just a clone because they were only able to like scrape off a little bit of her DNA. So they create a clone and put Chandu's head on, and Chandu's mad as heck because he's now a woman.
Yes, and again, is this satire? I think so.
So he loses his shit. And so Spider-Man's fighting everybody. And then She-Hulk, and then Spider-Man knocks Chandu's head off the clone and figures out, oh, this is a clone. She-Hulk, you should stand up because you're actually attached to your body. And then She-Hulk figures it out, everything. So then She-Hulk and Spider-Man are fighting the bad guys, the headmen.
Yeah, well, it's funny that She-Hulk kind of dismisses this whole thing because, you know, they're already doing this bit in Alpha Flight. So don't even, this doesn't even matter. She just breaks out and she's back to being herself again.
And at some point, like, she gets attacked by a giant tank. Like, this thing's great. Rob Liefeld could have designed this thing. And she just rips the tank in two.
When she breaks out of her container that she's in, we don't actually get to see that. And She-Hulk acknowledges the fact that, yeah, that's going to take too much time. So let's just pretend that you saw it and we'll move on from there. Acknowledging the fact that, yeah, we don't have time to see that.
Well, and this is something Byrne does throughout this is it's great where he's like, oh, I don't have time to explain this. So we're just going to have, we're just going to skip panels and we're just going to, instead of showing the action, we're just going to skip ahead, which is great.
Yeah, which is great. Saves time. Well, this brings us to issue 4, which I think you and I both can agree this is the one we're probably going to spend the most time on. And it is because, at least to me, this is where everything coalesces. This is everything Byrne's trying to do. It's got it all, Brian, including Stiltman.
Right.
Yes. First of all, we have a cover with a Surgeon General warning that this scene does not appear in this comic book. That is hilarious because there are so many comics that the cover art does not match
right.
the actual story itself. That is a ongoing running joke in comic books. I think
they gave up on that long time ago, and I don't have a problem with the cover not...
Well, cover was meant to grab the reader and say, oh, I want to buy this.
Attention.
Yeah.
And I think one of the weird things in life is like I'm a DC guy in many ways, more than a Marvel guy. And, you know, you're more of a Marvel guy than a DC guy. And so I think that works out well for our perspectives and things like that. But Marvel's covers are way better than DC's. And okay. I think that really started developing at a certain point. And this is a longer discussion, but it should be addressed because of the She-Hulk thing. Marvel has done an incredible job with their covers. And even recently, like their covers have nothing to do with the comic inside, but they're fantastic.
Yeah, they're always visually stunning.
Yes,
we can talk about variant covers later. Mm-hmm. But starting in what I think is the 70s, where you started having these really just brilliant, eye-catching, action-packed covers that would really get someone to oh, this looks great. But when you read the actual thing, you're like, wait, this didn't, the cover didn't happen. Mm-hmm. But that didn't matter. The cover was just to get you to start reading the book.
I think this is a topic for later.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
I think we could go off a bit on covers, which we won't do to our readers right now.
Let's put a pin in that and come back.
Yes, exactly. But yes, to your point, so this cover referenced the fact that covers are starting to not have anything to do with the comic inside, or not starting, they never have.
Yeah, it's acknowledging, yes, that it's, you know, that's been a common thing happening.
It's like a New Order song. The song titles have nothing to do with the song.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking precisely. So this issue begins with a wonderful 80s montage of dressing, getting dressed in different outfits.
Who would tag Byrne for a guy who would do like a fashion spread?
It's so good. I'm sorry, but the outfit she chose wouldn't have been my personal favorite, but it's very 80s with the big shoulders and everything.
Oh, so everything. This is such an 80s comic.
Oh my God, yes. So so she then has to get to work, She-Hulk, that is, has to get to work across town. So she turns to John Byrne and says, could you get me across town really quickly? So they do that by having a little cutaway to a B plot and then a return, and she's in there and she's, thanks, I appreciate that.
And throughout all these 8 issues, there's a wonderful thing that Byrne does with her moving across panels, and it's always head down, 1 foot forward, mm-hmm. right? And she's half in and half out of the panel. This happens all the time.
Once she truly, and this is the issue where she completely understands what it is. She knows that she's a comic book character, and she knows that I don't have to, you know, do this in real time. I can actually just walk across the panel and get across town. She-Hulk then gets to the DA's office where she's going to start work, and she meets Wheezy, who's the receptionist. Wheezy also knows she's in a comic book because Wheezy was a character, Louise Grant, or
the Blonde Phantom,
which was a comic book character, actual comic book character from the 40s. This is where I wanted to talk about the existential drama. So we get Wheezy's backstory. She was a comic book character, and that comic was basically forgotten. So she and her partner, who's also a superhero, they grew old because no one paid attention to them. And yes, her husband eventually died, and she is now trying to get herself into another comic so that she can live longer.
And there's the whole reference to once they are off panel or off comics, they age.
Yes.
There's a whole bit. There's like, we could, someone out there better than us could do an entire series of just the 3 or 4 pages of Wheezy talking like about her history.
There is so many implications here that is it's so interesting, but it's also terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
There's other, okay. So you get things like Toy Story. If you don't look at the toys, they come alive.
Right.
You know, but then there's also, you know, Harlan Ellison and Neil Gaiman, other authors also write about characters. Specifically, they write about gods. So if you don't believe in a god, the god dies.
Right.
But the more you believe in the god, the more powerful it becomes. And then you have that with Wheezy. If you read her comic books, she lives and she's young and she'll live forever. But if you don't read her comics, she will die. But she has beat the system by getting herself as a side character where she can be old and but still live and still manage to keep on living. There is so many crazy existential ideas that could be taken from this.
Yeah, it's one of the best moments in the comic. And I, in my notes here that I still do on paper, so I can do arrows and stars and underline. Right. At some point, we should show a picture of my notes.
You should do that. I'll put it on the site. I'll put it on the website.
This is my favorite, and we haven't even gotten to the truckers yet, and this is probably one of my favorite bits in this entire comic.
Yeah, it's amazing. We could do an entire show just on Wheezy and how comic book characters live in this. It's just, you know, it's insane.
If someone grabs the trade, go to page 86. I wrote down the page. Go to page 86 and you will be reading one of the great moments in contemporary comics history. Period.
And then this issue continues where Jen acknowledges, woof, you know, that she meets the DA and, you know, I thought it was a little early for a romantic interest. But Wheezy has to explain, no, he's married. And then she gets mad. She-Hulk gets mad at John Byrne for toying with her. And she tries to crawl through the panel to get at John Byrne. And Wheezy has to hold her back. But Wheezy has to hold her back and say, no, it's already been printed. That's a reader out there. It's not Byrne anymore.
That's right. Brilliant. They also have to cover up a certain bit of her.
Yes. there's a conveniently placed suitcase.
Briefcase.
And then, of course, I mean, this is all one page. We have that moment. And then Wheezy says, we have to go to lunch. So they walk across panels from the office to the restaurant.
Because they don't have time to get there.
Oh,
and that reminds me of the great panel. It's one of those, and Byrne uses this a lot, but this is one of the best examples, is there's a panel of Wheezy and She-Hulk walking, and the panel is the very top of Wheezy's head, and so you have the top of Wheezy's head, and right next to her is a headless She-Hulk with only a portion of her body. It's that great spatial, I mean, this is art. I mean, this is what artists do, is like spatial recognition. It's a great panel.
Oh, yeah. It
took Byrne probably 5 minutes to draw it. Yet it's fantastic.
So we get Wheezy's backstory over lunch, which is funny, but also tragic at the same time. And then, of course, we get the fabulous introduction of Stiltman. Easily one of the greatest villains in comic book history.
Certainly.
If we could have Stiltman team up with Kite Man, I think that's a crossover just waiting to happen.
Let's make this happen.
Yeah. Kite Man and Stiltman. So
because I think Kelly Sue and Matt Fraction are just waiting in the wings to write a Kite Man Stiltman crossover.
Anyway, you have thoughts on Stiltman.
Well, no, I just think that, again, I'm beating a dead horse, but I can't stop talking about the visuals in this comic. Most of Stiltman, almost all of Stiltman, is represented with just his bottom half. right? Yeah. Just legs. Like I'm trying to think if we ever see his top half. We may see it briefly.
Well, she tries to, She-Hulk that is, tries to unmask him. So yeah, right. She crawls up his legs and then tries to unmask him. But
the vast majority of the story, the battle against Stiltman, is just his legs. What Byrne does visually with his legs, and there's the great scene where one of his legs comes down, and you see it coming down over several panels while she and Weezy are having lunch, and he just shoves She-Hulk down into the ground, and you just have this whole watching a panel after panel, watching her get deep further into the ground until her head is stuck underground and a subway comes through. Oh, and God. Then you have a bunch of panels with the subway driving through her head.
And the reaction of the people in the subway car is like, oh my God, it's her head being ripped through the top of the subway car.
Right. And then every other panel is just She-Hulk or Weezy, who saves the day by getting lard. I love comics.
I do too. Yeah.
Getting lard so that Stiltman trips up.
Yeah. And apparently Mario is the one helping her.
Right. He says,
I come as fast as I can. It's a heavy.
And again, all of those panels are just the legs, the stilt legs. It's physical comedy. Byrne is showing physical comedy in this that is outstanding. It just is great art. This is why we love comics. And then it ends up with She-Hulk in a scene that will make every man uncomfortable. Grabs both of his legs, Stiltman's legs, and rips him in two.
Yeah, saying, make a wish. And she rips him apart like a wishbone.
From his legs to his crotch. Of course, obviously, Stiltman, the stilts aren't real. And then she catches the actual Stiltman as he falls. But that is like a nightmarish.
There's a few other gags right at the end of this. Like, it cuts to a scene afterwards. And She-Hulk actually commends John Byrne. Like, oh, good captioning. Great, good transition. That was great. And Weezy wonders why, because She-Hulk's in basically a negligee, it looks like. And she's wondering why that didn't rip off as well as the rest of her clothes. And then she sees the comic book's code authority seal of approval and the tag on her clothes. So, that's the reason. It's
you know, visual gag after visual gag after visual gag rendered brilliantly.
Yes, I saw that. It was just like, mwah, bravo, sir. Chef's kiss. Like I said, that's kind of like the middle of the run right there. And this just sums up everything that's great about this series. It's visual brilliance. The gags are great. And there's a little bit of existential dread in there as well. It is a classic issue.
It's like top 20 single issues of all time.
Okay. I think let's try to speed up our run through of these, because I think everyone gets the idea. This is just a visually brilliant and wonderful satire.
The peak is 4. Every other issue afterwards is great. Everyone should read issue 4.
Issue 5 has a really great gag of someone is controlling Saturday morning cartoons, which turns them into a nightmare world, and people are drawn into the nightmare world of Saturday morning cartoons.
It's funny stuff. It features Dr. Bong, which anybody who is a Howard the Duck fan would, to me, issue 5 is the most 70s.
Absolutely.
Of a comic. And it basically involves She-Hulk going through a whole bunch of lots of visual gags about Saturday morning cartoons that, of course, there's George O'Rocket and his wife, Jane.
Well, RoboCop makes a...
Robot
Cop, yes. It's Robot Cop.
Which they can't make fun of because it's a Marvel property, and so they have to be careful.
Yes, She-Hulk actually has to cover the mouth of a kid to say, don't say that name, in much the same way as the Simpsons classic Shining episode. Don't you mean The Shining? Do you want to get us sued?
It's great. It's fun. It's not the strongest, although, again, it's Dr. Bong and Fifi. Fifi's there. a humorous bit about don't press this button, the button gets pressed.
Exactly. Yeah, big red button of doom. Speaking of doom, She-Hulk has to, again, admonish John Byrne, saying, really, in this issue, the Fantastic Four got Dr. Doom and I get Dr. Bong. Yeah, there's some really great stuff in here. I mean, you have the parody of the Flintstones and Yogi Bear is a real bear.
Right.
That attacks people.
It's visually very good. The story is humorous, but it feels, I don't want to say fillery because it's not filler, but it is. It's a one-off story.
Yeah, and Dr. Bong ends with his Bong children watching cartoons.
And the fact that Dr. Bong had quintuplets that are all little babies with the bell on their heads. That's good stuff. It's funny that they do that whilst he is still probably not pals with Steve Gerber.
But this is it. He is ultimately defeated because She-Hulk, she says, I'm not playing by his rules. I'm going to play by my rules. And with that, she rips the page and runs through the letters section. Or it's an advertisement. She basically runs through an advertisement to get to the end of the story.
It's Bud Plant or Mile High Comics. We all know the ads in the comics where they're selling
back issues. Yeah.
Back issues. Remember that time when that you would order back issues by mail order based on what was in the comic books you were reading?
Yep.
Yeah, and that's a great moment too. Is like she's literally running across what would be like Mile High or Bud Plant or whoever.
Yeah,
and of course
the other characters have no idea what's going on. She's like, "Don't think about it, just do it."
There's a lot of text involved, and I have to confess, I didn't stop and read all of the text because it's comics, not a book.
So the big red button of doom gets pushed with a caption that says, "Okay, who didn't see this coming?"
Right.
Absolutely fantastic. So do you want to do space trucking?
Sure.
This is your forte.
Is it though?
Trucking culture. Come on. You love the trucking culture.
Well, it's weird, right? So the next two issues involve trucking culture. And by trucking culture, this is a thing that exists in the 60s and 70s, mostly. I have an interest in this. I have, I am somebody who has had some music websites and done some things and have written some things about, and one of my great passions is trucking music. And there's way more of it than you would think about. It doesn't matter. I'm not pimping myself here.
It goes way beyond Convoy, let's just say.
Yes. Well, then that's the very least of, So the next two issues are a very humorous callback to a comic book from the early 80s when Marvel was doing some of their cross-promotional things. So there was a toy company that was doing, this is 182, 83, somewhere around in there.
Yeah, this is 78 to 80, 85, I guess, where Marvel was just pimping themselves out to anything. Any right. toy company, right. any... property anything
yes. So there was a toy company that wanted to start a line of trucks to sell, like toy trucks. I had toy trucks growing up.
Tell us about them.
So in the early 80s, I think Ralph Macchio was involved, they did a comic called US One
Readers Zero.
It was about a truck driver who had some experience with aliens, and somehow he was able to psychically communicate via CB radio. He could send and receive CB radio responses in his head. And I think his name was Ulysses Solomon Archer. So he was called US-1. And this was a comic book that actually existed. It existed. I can't believe I haven't recommended it yet, and maybe we'll do it someday. It ran for 12 issues.
Which is shocking in and of itself. 12 whole issues. Yes.
Yeah. But, the cast of characters in it were, there was an alien named Al. there was Papa Wheelie. And Wide Load Annie and Retread.
Papa Wheelie.
Papa Wheelie and Wide Load Annie. And of course, we could all guess what a Wide Load Annie looked like.
Yes.
This really existed, and it was terrestrial. So the next two episodes of She-Hulk bring back US-1, only now as a space truckers.
Yes, they have gone into space and set up their own truck stop and
There's
hauling
a truck
business.
Stop in space.
It's a truck stop in space where they actually have their own hauling company in space. They're space truckers. Deep Purple would be proud.
There's an existing trucker in the U.S. still, like on Earth, called Razorback, who is from Arkansas, and he's a super-powered trucker from Arkansas.
Suey pig, pig, pig.
It's enlisted by another woman, Taryn, who apparently, according to her, was like a important trucker as well. We don't see any of the evidence of that.
She was left behind when all the other truckers, when the US
all
one
the
crew
truckers went up to space, and she was left behind. So she's lovelorn, and so she hires the Arkansas superhero trucker Razorback to help her steal a spaceship,
a space shuttle. To hijack shuttle. The space shuttle, being launched in a joint venture between NASA and the Fantastic Four.
Right.
Because Reed Richards is, for some reason, running the operation.
Reed Richards is the cameo in this issue.
Yes. They hijack the space shuttle, and She-Hulk has to catch up with the space shuttle by bouncing off of an inflated Reed Richards. space, because, of course... She-Hulk does say that she wants to say up, up, and away, but that's copyright infringement, so she won't. So she does catch up with the space shuttle.
And off they go into space to find the truck stop, the outer space truck stop, because part of the shtick is that space needs truckers. Aliens need truckers.
Absolutely one of the best deep cuts, I think. She-Hulk looks out into space and says, "This is boring. Come on, burn. I need something more spectacular than this." And you get a 2-page spread of a Kirby-like photo collage that he used to do for Fantastic Four.
And it's lovely.
And to which She-Hulk says, "That's better." Yeah, it's really, it's a great gag, but it's also a nice homage to Kirby.
Right. So eventually they get to this truck stop, outer space truck stop. And then they're in the truck stop and Taryn finds out that U.S., has already hooked up with one of her other friends and they have a baby on the way. So she's sad because they literally hijacked a space shuttle to go find the guy. And so she's having sads.
We didn't really describe Razorback. He actually has a giant mask, like a giant pig head on his, like a hog, as a head with his face cut out of it. It's the most ridiculous thing you've ever seen. The issue ends with Zemo attacking the truck stop.
And Zemo is a cute, you know, furry teddy bear looking thing with a horrendous mouth. Or no, it does. I'm sorry.
He has no mouth.
And he has no mouth and he is mean.
Yes, which is a wonderful reference to the Harlan Ellison short story.
So it ends with him crashing US-1. So US-1 is missing. So he crashes the US-1's. Some of this is, we're getting an absurdity here in a wonderful way, but you got to read this. We can't really fully describe how batshit nuts.
It really does. And it gets incredibly weirder from there. Zemo tries to, of course, mind control She-Hulk into becoming his mate.
Yeah, I mean, I think he calls her the bride of Zemo. The whole point of Zemo is like he wants to get the baby, so he's lonely and he populates his. So this is a character that does exist in the Marvel Universe before this. So his whole shtick is trying to populate his planet, so he steals human children. But what he decided is like the human children he kidnaps are already have opinions and feelings. He needs to get a baby that hasn't been born yet.
So Taryn's
friend and romantic rival, Mary, who is pregnant with US-1's baby, is what Zemu is coming for, because there are no other pregnant people in the universe.
Yeah, it has to be that one.
It has to be that one. But then issue 7 just falls completely off. You'll be surprised to hear this. Completely falls off the rails.
He attempts to turn She-Hulk into one of his people.
Because he put them all to sleep. And the other thing we're missing here is She-Hulk also has having weird sexy time dreams about Hercules. I believe we see this develop later on in the comic. So he captures everybody, including Fat Load Annie and Reach Red and all of these people.
Wide Load Annie, not Fat Load.
Wide Load Annie.
Wow, you actually made it more offensive than John Byrne did. That's neat.
Well, it wasn't John Byrne that created the character.
That's true. That's true.
That's not his naming. But like at some point, She-Hulk, so Zemu's powers just put people to sleep. And so he keeps putting them to sleep, and then they wake up and they try to get free, and then he puts them to sleep again.
But somehow, actually, by the way, we're rambling on about this comic. I think that might be our superpower as well.
It might be.
Yes.
So at the end of the day, goofy crap happens. Just read it. I can't even describe how much fun this is. We have a super hairy She-Hulk at some point.
Yes, and then there's a giant baby man. Okay, I'm going to say this sentence out loud. Eventually, the whole story is resolved by a giant baby man taking Zemu as his pet teddy bear, and he will love him forever and ever.
And then She-Hulk finally gets sent. So everything is resolved, and the universe, Razorback gets to be another, because they need another space trucker.
Everyone,
we can always use two space truckers.
Yeah, everyone needs space truckers.
Earth is the only planet that has been able to successfully create space truckers.
So, of course, She-Hulk gets home by driving a classic Dodge.
59 Dodge
spaceship. 59 Dodge spaceship. It's silly. It's incredibly silly. She-Hulk gets back to Earth, and she meets up with Nick St. Christopher, it's Santa Claus.
It's Santa Claus.
Yes. Yeah. It's bookended by Christmas-themed issues. Right. And it's all very silly. She's still having dreams of sexy time Hercules. With Hercules.
We should note that the title of this issue is The World's Greatest Detective.
Well, this is an interesting thing because it's something that it was never followed up on, but Lex Luthor is essentially introduced in this. And that was Byrne's intent, was to have, if not Lex Luthor himself, then a Lex Luthor type of character.
But he was referenced in, and so, kind of shown a silhouette at one time where he's like a man named Mr. L, who is bald and in silhouette.
Yeah, yeah, so. It's no uncertain terms. It is Lex Luthor, who was, I believe, was meant to be the ongoing villain. And of course, that was never followed up on because Byrne left the title and didn't come back for a while.
Well, and there's a Mr. Powers that gets an apartment.
Yes.
In one of the issues.
There's a lot of what could be mm-hmm. in this. For the first time, we get to see Jen Walters in court as a lawyer. It took a while to get there, but she's actually in court now. Anyway, it's a very silly issue where she has to
solve a murder case, or she has to prosecute a murder case, and Santa Claus basically comes and helps her.
Exactly. And then he perves on her and has to be scolded by Mrs. Claus. And so ends the first 8 issues of Sensational She-Hulk.
Go down and up a chimney.
Yeah.
Again, has great visual.
And I know I'm breezing past this one because this one's sort of...
It's fun, but it's
yeah. It's yes.
It's not issue 4.
Exactly.
It's not the Stilt Man issue.
I mean, obviously we both like this quite a bit. Mm-hmm. I stand by my initial comment that this is incredibly influential and this is an important comic because it changed a lot of how people think about comics, or at least writers and creators think about comics going forward. Right. Yeah. A lot of self-referential, a lot of meta comments, a lot of playing with the medium itself takes place after this. And like you said, it's kind of in the zeitgeist at this point because Morrison's doing it and to a certain extent, Gaiman's doing it. But I think this just came at just the right time and mm-hmm. it does it so brilliantly that this is a very special comic.
From a creator that has taken some hits over the years that is probably deserved, and not everything that he was received accolades for in the past has stood the test of time. Mm-hmm. But this one most certainly does.
Yes. There are some problematic elements. I mean, it's a comic book from the 80s. Not everything ages well.
There's a level of cheesecake that maybe the male gaze needed to settle down a little bit with, but...
Yeah, and just, you know, but for the most part, I mean, as much as she's put in various forms of peril and mind control and whatnot, She-Hulk, Jen Walters, always has, you know, she gets herself out. No one's saving her. She's saving herself. She has a level of agency that wasn't always found in comics of this era. We talked about it earlier. Was this intentional or was it accidental? Doesn't matter. You know, we can read into it what we see.
But this is at the end of the day, it's fun.
Oh yeah, it's just fun, and there are some serious.
I know that we land on that assessment a lot, but that at some point is what we want.
Yes, we read comic books to be entertained. We watch movies and TV shows to be entertained. I never go into something saying I want to hate this. No, I go into everything wanting to like it. And when I do, you know, and when it's really well done and really entertaining, it makes it so much more enjoyable.
And what entertains us can vary based on what we want to be entertained by. It's, do I want to be entertained by Faulkner? Well, reading Faulkner entertains me. It doesn't entertain everybody else, and it entertains me in a different way than reading She-Hulk.
Yeah.
I get to be entertained by different things depending on how I want to be entertained at a given time. This is just, you know, can I, again, not Morrison or Gaiman, you know, can I read Alan Moore? Can I read Gaiman? Can I read... And will that make me think? And does thinking about things entertain me? Sure. That sounded really weird. But I also really enjoy, and the reason I love comics is that I can be entertained by something that is intended to be humorous, that's intended to be referential, that's intended to not necessarily be as deep as other things. And
yeah. But this also it breaks down the mechanics of comic books, and it gives you an insight into, you know, why is it that I like this particular medium? Why is it that I like reading comic books? And you can look at this comic book and say, oh, it's because of these particular things. Right. It's like it said, it's breaking down the mechanics, and it's satirizing and parodying those mechanics. But at the same time, they're tropes and cliches for a reason, because they work. This is a incredibly fun, incredibly funny, enjoyable comic. At the end of the day, it can also make you think. And thinking about thinking is makes you think.
And a medium that talks about itself is not necessarily a negative.
Right.
You know, mediums do talk about themselves. So, no, this is, I am really happy you recommended this. I read it when it came out, and I probably hadn't really revisited it in a serious way until now. So this is great.
Cool. All right. Definitely recommend this. Please go out and get it. Yeah.
Highly recommended. So typically this would be my turn to recommend something, but Paul has very kindly stepped in due to my having some sads lately and my inability to settle on a comic. Paul has graciously stepped in and done a second recommendation in a row. And so, Paul, would you like to tell us what we will be reading next?
Yes, for the upcoming greatest holiday of the year, Halloween, we will be reading Rachel Rising. It is a comic book by Terry Moore. Specifically, we'll be reading the first trade, The Shadow of Death. Radical departure from what we just read.
Yes.
Yeah. Which gets into your point of, you know, we read different things. We're entertained by different things. And this one is going to be quite different.
And so, Terry Moore is a master.
Yes.
I'm glad we are finally reading something by. So this is a perfect recommendation for the season coming up.
To reiterate, Rachel Rising, Volume 1, The Shadow of Death by Terry Moore. This went a little long, so let's just get out of here, Brian.
Yep.
Okay. Let us know what you think on Twitter or on our website, collectedition.podcast.com, and all the other information will be in the end tag that I put on the end of every episode, unless I forget. So, with that being said, until next time, keep reading comics.
Toodaloo, everybody.
Wow. Shaking it up.
I know.
You've been listening to The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast. The Collected Edition is a Daddy Elk production. All materials used on the show are copyright their respective copyright holders, and no infringement is intended. The show can be found on iTunes, Stitcher, and Google Play, as well as online at collectededitionpodcast.com, where comments can be left on individual episodes. You can also send us feedback at comments@collectededitionpodcast.com or on Twitter at collectededpod, that's collected, E-D-P-O-D. The Collected Edition, a comic book podcast, is for entertainment purposes only.
Are you not entertained?